When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, History Hit listeners. Everyone loves the ancients with Tristan Hughes. In the office, we call him the Tristorian. We make fun of him, but now he's a monster broadcaster in his own right, so it's less funny than it used to be. The joke's on us. He's an absolute legend. He convinced us years ago that there was an appetite for ultra-detailed ancient history in a podcast format, and you know what? He was right. If, frankly, the classical fare you're getting on this podcast is too meagre, then you need to get involved in the ancients. He goes really deep. You're going to love it. Check out The Ancients with Tristan Hughes wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Ancients on History Hit. I'm Tristan Hughes, your host, and in today's podcast, we've got a special treat for you today because a few months back, I was fortunate enough to head over to Egypt to film a series of documentaries for History Hit. And one of them was all about the greatest, or one of the greatest, definitely the biggest temple complex of the ancient world. This is the temple complex of Karnak, which boasts some 4,000, yes, you heard that right, 4,000 years of history, stretching from the Middle Kingdom, the Middle Egyptian Kingdom, to Champollion, to Jean-François Champollion, the deciphering of hieroglyphs. And in this special podcast episode, it's taken from our recent documentary, released on History Hit, all about Karnak, I chatted to El-Tayeb Gharieb Mahmoud, Tayeb, who is the director of Karnak Temples. This man knows everything that there is to know about Karnak temples. He knows where each hieroglyph is, what each hieroglyph means. He is a walking encyclopedia for all things Karnak. And we were lucky enough, fortunate enough, to have some of his time when we visited Karnak a few months ago. And in this podcast episode, it's a mix of me sitting down with Tayeb in the great hypostyle hall of Seti I, and also a bit of a walk around too, looking at some other features such as the White Chapel of Senesret I. That's all to come in this very special On Location in Egypt Ancients podcast. The first time we're doing an Ancients podcast outside of the UK. It's another symbol of how we're always growing, always wanting to get bigger and better on the ancients. But without further ado, that's enough rambling on from me. Here's Tayeb to talk all about Karnak. Tayeb, first of all, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you so much. You're welcome.
I am so envious of your job and where you work here at Karnak because it's such an incredible sight. I mean, we're talking from inside the Hypostyle Hall, one of the most iconic monuments here. I'd like to ask you a few questions about this site, about Karnak now, if I may. I mean, first of all, Karnak in ancient Egypt, what exactly is Karnak?
Karnak, it's a biggest and greatest religious temple over the world. When we talk about Karnak, we are talking about more than 247 hectares.
Type, that's insane, the size. I mean, as you say, this is one of, if not the largest religious sanctuary in the world or in the ancient world?
In the ancient world, exactly, in the ancient world. So, when we talk about Karnak, we are talking about more than 247 acres.
Acres, right.
More than 15 temples built for many gods and goddesses and kings inside this area. For example, we have the great temple and the main temple of the god Amun-Ra, the temple of the king Ramses II, the temple of the king Ramses III, temple of the god Ptah, temple of the god Khonsu and Obed. We are talking about more than 15 temples built during different times of the Egyptian civilization as dedication for these gods and goddesses.
And of all the gods and goddesses that were worshipped at Karnak, you mentioned Amun there. Does Amun seem to be this main deity which is worshipped at Karnak?
Exactly. The main god. Not just in Karnak. Actually, the main deity during the New Kingdom and until the end of the Egyptian civilization was the god Amun-Ra, which means that we are talking about more than 2,000 years. And the god Amun-Ra, he was the main god and the main deity in the Egyptian civilization.
And was Amun, was he a local god? I mean, do we think his, the cult of Amun, if we can say that, did it originate in this area of Egypt and Upper Egypt around the ancient city of Thebes?
Actually, Amun, he was a local god. At the beginning, when he was in Ilminia, in Khimenu, and this is the original city of the god Amun. But later, when he came to Luxor, step by step, he became the main god. And at the beginning, he was a local god, but later, he became one of the first creator for the world, even for the cosmos, so that he became an international god.
And Tayyip, going on from that, I mean, an international god, thousands of years of history. We can talk about various sanctuaries around, well, various temples and shrines and chapels here,
exactly,
which dedicated to Amun. But it does also beg the question, do we know where it all begins, the whole sanctuary of Karnak? Do we know about the origins of this sanctuary?
Yes, yes, of course, of course. Actually, we think that the starting of building in Karnak, at least starting during the time of the 12th dynasty and the Middle Kingdom. And still we have the Oben court, which belongs to that time. But this is at least, because actually we think that the building of Karnak temples started before. For many proofs, for many evidences, one of them that still we have names of the kings from the old kingdom, like the king Senefro, the king Jedkara Isisi. All of these kings' names still exist on the list of the king Thutmose III in the festival in the temple of Akhmenu. So we think that the building of Karnak temples was initiated during the old kingdom. Of course, we didn't find until this moment a real and clear evidence. But some evidences prove that. But anyway, we are talking about more than 2,000 years. Why? Because
2,000 BC. Are you talking more than 2,000 BC?
Exactly, exactly. Why? Because the first part of the temple, the oldest part of the temple, started during the time of the king Sinuserd I, Sinuserd I, in around 1960 BC. And this is the white chapel, which we found in blocks as fill inside the third pylon, which belongs to the time of the king Amenophis III. He used these blocks and many thousands of blocks as fill inside his gate, the third pylon. And during our restoration and preservation for this part of the temple, the third gate, we found all of these blocks. And we started to reconstruct again all of them in an area. We called it Open Air Museum, and still all of these chapels and shrines exist right there, like the white chapel, the alabaster chapel, the chapel of the Queen Hatshepsut, the red chapel, many chapels. Actually, we found all of these blocks as fill inside the third pylon, and until this moment we are trying to reconstruct all of these chapels again in the Open Air Museum.
Well, you mentioned the Whitechapel there, so let's go and have a look.
Okay, let's go.
As Tyab mentioned, the Whitechapel is now situated to the side of Karnak in the Open Air Museum. Beautifully and accurately reconstructed, the building is some 4,000 years old.
This is the Whitechapel. The Whitechapel. Yes. This is the oldest part of Karnak complex. This is the most ancient part of Karnak temples, dated to the king, to the time of the king Sinusert I.
And can you see his name at all on here, Tyab?
Yes, this is the name of the king, Sinusert.
Usret.
This is the old name, this is the hieroglyphs name of the king Sinusert, around 1960 BC.
Wow.
During the 12th dynasty. And actually, there is no part of the temple older than this shrine.
So this shrine is basically almost 4,000 years
around
old.
Around 4,000 years, exactly.
That's incredible.
It's in the detail all over the walls of this Whitechapel, where you can see evidence of the close relationship pharaohs wish to stress between themselves and the god Amun. And Tyab is taking me, first of all, to a particular depiction of Amun, all to do with fertility. And this is a depiction that shows Amun with a very erect penis. There's no other way to say it. And standing opposite this depiction, this version of Amun, is a depiction of the pharaoh Senizret I with his royal regalia.
And so do we see depictions of Amun on the walls of this shrine?
Yes, of course. We can
have
see
a look. Yes.
Here, the depiction of the god Amun, and we can read his name. Jedmidu en Imen Kamutef. Nisut Nitiru.
So Kamutef, is this a particular version of Amun?
Yes, exactly.
Right.
And his, like, in his name, like this, it was the Ithyphallic Amun. Because actually we have two forms of the god Amun. The first one as the king of the sky, as the god of the sky and the sun. On the other side, we have the other name, Amun-Ra Kamutef, and in this case, he is the Ithyphallic Amun, the god of the fertility and the sexual life in ancient times.
So fertility, this version of Amun is all to do with fertility.
Exactly.
Right.
And we can see the image of the god Amun.
Yes,
reacting like this.
And I guess, is that Senizret there on the right and that's Amun on the left?
Exactly. This is
okay.
The depiction of the king Sinusert and his offer, a bread as offering in front of the Ithyphallic god Amun-Ra or Amun-Kamutef.
And you can see the headdress that he's wearing, crowns, and with the serpent, little headdress there. Mm-hmm. Do we know what sort of crown this was? Was this the one that just represented a pharaoh?
Actually, in this form, the king Sinusert, he's wearing the white crown.
The white crown.
Yes, this is just the white crown, the crown of Upper Egypt.
The crown of Upper Egypt. So was there a different crown if he was king of Lower Egypt?
Exactly. We have the red crown and the red crown for Lower Egypt. And we can see it right here.
Oh, this is the red crown.
Yes,
you can see how different it is.
Yes. Exactly.
Right. So Lower Egypt, that's the end closer to the Nile Delta, to Memphis and that
exactly,
area.
Exactly.
Right.
From Memphis to Alexandria, to the coast of the Mediterranean Sea.
Oh,
this is
okay.
Which we called the Lower Egypt.
Got it.
Yeah.
And Upper Egypt, where we are at the moment in Karnak and Thebes, ancient Thebes, this was
Upper
Egypt.
Actually, we are in the center, in the heart of our Egypt.
Ah.
And we are in the capital of Upper Egypt, at that time, Thebes, Luxor nowadays.
Now, a key role of Karnak was as a home of the Sed festival. This was an official renewal ceremony of a pharaoh's power some 3 decades, 30 years into their reign. And the function of the Whitechapel of Senizret I may well be aligned with this Sed festival.
Some Egyptologists think that this shrine for the Sed festival. And the Sed festival, it was very important for the Egyptian king to renewing his life, to renewing his power. So he used to celebrate with this festival after 30 years of his reign, of his
ruling for the country. And during this festival, he used to make many ceremonies, many rituals in front of the common people to prove that he can control Egypt. He can rule for another 30 years. So that sometimes he used to control a pool to show his power, to show his strength for his people. So that maybe this shrine used for this purpose, for this function, where we can see the name of the said festival.
Oh yes, down there. Here. So it's down
yeah,
here, is it?
Exactly.
Ah, okay,
down here,
yes.
We can see the name of the said festival.
Right. After 30 years on the throne, this important festival, the revival of your strength,
exactly.
of your power, and yeah. it was incredibly significant and important
exactly.
for the pharaohs, for their people.
Yeah, that's right.
So actually, Tyre, from what you were saying, so this altar here in the center, does this not date, therefore, to the time of Senizret I? Is this later? Was there originally something else in the center?
Exactly. This is the point. Some Egyptologists think that this part of the shrine, the altar, the granite altar, added later to the time of the king Senizret. But originally, we had a royal throne here, double royal throne for the two faces, the two entrances, and the king, he acting at that time himself as the king of Lower Egypt and the king of Upper Egypt during the Sid festival.
Senizret's legacy at Karnak is clear thanks to the preserved White Chapel. This often overlooked building, now to the side of the main temple complex, full to the brim with invaluable hieroglyphs and imagery. Well, this White Chapel, it emphasizes the importance of Karnak and Amun for pharaohs as early as 2000 BC. But 2000 BC, well, this was only the beginning. Karnak's importance increased over the following centuries. And by the time that the Egyptian New Kingdom dawned in the mid-second millennium BC with the famous 18th dynasty, Karnak was well on its way to becoming the monumental complex you can still see today. So, Tayyip, you see all of these constructions, and by the time you get to the famous 18th dynasty, the likes of Tutankhamun and so many others, does it feel like this is a real golden age for Karnak?
Yes, of course, we can say that, for sure. The golden age of Karnak temples, it was during the New Kingdom and especially the 18th dynasty. Why? Because the great builders of Karnak temples was at that time, like the Queen Hatshepsut, the King Amenophis I, the King Thutmosis III. He was one of the real builder of Karnak temples, especially the heart and the central area. And of course, the king Ramesses, the king Seti I, actually the golden age and the golden times of Karnak temples, it was during the New Kingdom and especially during the 18th dynasty.
Well, you mentioned, I mean, there's so many names there we could pursue, but as we are talking from the Hypostyle Hall, I feel we need to kick it off with Seti I. I mean, Tayyip, talk to me a bit about who Seti I was when he was reigning and what's his great contribution to Karnak.
Actually, the king Seti I, he was one of the builder of Karnak temples, and he started in a very special part of Karnak temples, and this is the Hypostyle Hall. Because actually the Hypostyle Hall before Seti I, it was very simple, just a corridor in the middle surrounded by columns and two walls. But later, during the time of the king Seti, at the beginning of the 19th dynasty, around 1290 BC, he started to add more columns. He removed both of the walls on each side, and he started to add more columns and built 122 columns.
So 134, therefore, in total.
Yes, the 12 in the middle, the larger one, this belongs to the time of the king Amenophis, and the 122, this belongs to the time of the king Seti. And he started the work in the northern part, but he died before he finished his work, so that his successor and his son, the king, the great king Ramesses, he completed the work of his father and finished it in the northern part, and he continued in the southern part. One of the most important parts which belongs to the time of the king, Seti I, it's the military scenes, which we can see on the northern exterior wall of the hypostyle hall, where we can see the king in the battlefield when he tried to invade Palestine to save the boundaries of Egypt against some tribes who wanted to invade Egypt. So that in his first year of his reign, he started to stop all of these tribes to enter to Egypt, to make kind of hostilities against Egypt. So that he led his army, marched to the north, and he started some battles against some tribes in Palestine called Shasu. And he reached to Lebanon, and he brought some wood, the cedar wood, from there, and he come back again. So the king Seti, he was one of the most important kings who helped and built special buildings in Karnak temples.
So he's a pharaoh that you can see the legacy of today in Karnak. You can see his military legacy, as you mentioned, on that exterior wall, his military achievements. But also, we are sitting in the hypostyle hall at one of those 122 columns. You can see his architectural achievements too. I mean, the building achievements. It's got Seti all over the place. I know it's got Ramesses, his son and successor, there too. But if you come to somewhere like Karnak, you can't help but know or hear or think of the name Seti I.
Yes, of course, Seti I. He was the father of the King Ramesses. And by the way, the King Ramesses, he ruled for 67 years.
That's insane back then. That is
yes,
insane.
It was a long time to do something like this. But his father, Seti, he didn't rule like his son, because he was so old, so he died early. I want to say, maybe if the king Seti, he lived more, he could do something amazing, more than the hypostyle hall or more than the military scenes which he represented on the exterior wall of the hypostyle hall. But anyway, even his time was so short, the king Seti, he did something amazing in Karnak, like the hypostyle hall, which they spent more than 120 years just in this part of the temple. And until this moment, we think that it's the most impressive part of all of Karnak complex.
It is incredibly impressive, absolutely indeed. Let's go and have a walk around.
Yeah, let's go.
I'm Professor Susanna Lipscomb, and on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, I'm looking for answers to the big questions about every aspect of life in the early modern period. Like, how did the memory of Anne Boleyn continue to influence the court of her daughter, Elizabeth I? How were fairies brought to life on the Elizabethan stage? And how did the arrival of male-only doctors threaten the lives of women? In other words, not just the Tudors, but most definitely also the Tudors. Twice a week, every week. Subscribe now and follow me on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful, Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. And also remember, when you use a messaging app, they shrink the photos. You cannot print those out. You cannot blow them up. This is high-quality imagery going to one of the most important people in your life. The Aura app is super easy to set up. It takes about 2 minutes, and you're going to love it. There's free unlimited storage, Add unlimited photos and videos and invite as many people as you want to a frame. Right now, Aura has got a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's A-U-R-A frames.com. Use code DANSNOW at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
Weaving your way through the massive columns of the Hypostyle Hall is quite unlike anything I've ever experienced. It's incredible, the feelings you get. You see the reliefs, the hieroglyphs, the huge cartouches visible all around you, and the size of the structure in itself, the size of the columns you're walking through, you're weaving your way through, well, they make you feel quite small indeed. But what was the function of the Hypostyle Hall? What was it used for?
The function to build the Hypostyle Hall was a kind of imitation for the myth and the legend of Horus.
The legend of Horus?
Exactly. Okay. When the god Osiris, he died, the legal heir, he was his son, and his successor, the god Horus.
Right.
But his uncle, he refused this, and he tried to kill him to take the throne of Egypt, so that the mother of the god Horus, the goddess Isis, tried to hide them in the marshes of El Delta, which fell off papyrus flowers and trees. She tried to hide him inside and in between these trees and these papyrus flowers as a legal heir of the throne of Egypt, so that they did the same here in the Hypostyle Hall, which looks like a veritable forest in stone.
Yes, because you've got these columns here at the end, you know, these closed papyrus columns.
Exactly.
Those gigantic open papyrus ones in the center, that central colonnade.
This is the point.
That's the point. So they represent the papyri of this myth, of this legend of Horus.
Exactly.
The Hypostyle Hall contains a total of 134 columns. The vast majority, 122 of them in fact, are 15 meter high closed papyrus columns. So called because the top of each column resembles a closed papyrus flower. The 12 gigantic 22 meter high columns that form the hall's central colonnade are open papyrus. Open, as their tops resemble an open papyrus flower.
Why sometimes open, sometimes closed? We think this is, it depends on the sunlight. Why? Because originally this part of the temple was roofed.
Right.
So that the flowers on each side, it's completely under the shade, so it's not grown up easily. But in the middle, the larger columns, the sun comes from the small windows up there.
Ah, so those small slits, yes.
Exactly.
Okay.
So it takes the sun easily so that it's grown up so easy. So that it depends on the light, it's the flower grown up or not grown up. This part of the temple, the Hypostyle Hall, it was for the most important people, like the royal family, the people around the king, just to enter and to be in this part of the temple, to make kind of rituals and ceremonies.
So completely unlike today, where anyone can come in, you know, it's such a popular attraction, as we can see right now.
Of course not.
Back in ancient Egypt, no one would have been allowed in, no one of the common people, as you said. It was special access.
No way.
But perhaps the most striking aspect of the Hypostyle Hall's busy central colonnade is the colour that you can still see so clearly on these columns.
And Tayyip, the colour here is absolutely incredible. You'd be forgiven for thinking it's been painted on, but no. I mean, what's the story behind this beautiful colour?
No way. All of these colours are original.
They belong
to the time, yes,
wow.
Yes. Inspired the Hayab style hall was initiated, the work was initiated during the time of the king Amenophis III, just in the middle part.
Yes.
And we are talking around 1390 BC. But the decoration of the Hayab style hall was begun during the time of the king Seti, father of the king Ramses. And the king Ramses, the son of the king Seti and his successor, he finished the whole work and the decoration of the Hayab style hall. You can see the remaining of the colors everywhere. It's amazing to see all of these colors after 3,000 years, which we used to see it covered by dust and the smog. And now we can see it very clear after the project, which we started about 8 months ago.
Now, on these colored columns, you can see depictions of Ramesses II making offerings to various gods, particularly various forms of Amun, the fertility version of Amun, but also the version of Amun that becomes very prominent at the time of the 18th dynasty and from then on, where Amun becomes the god of the universe, the head god, Amun-Ra. On one column, you can see Ramesses offering milk to Amun. On another, he's offering red wine. On another, there's bread, and so on. It is the Hypostyle Hall. It's an absolutely stunning structure. But it wasn't just men who built at Karnak in ancient Egyptian times. Women also built here too. Particularly a remarkable 18th dynasty pharaoh called Hatshepsut. Now, Tayeb, keeping on the 18th dynasty, the famous 18th dynasty, I'd love to ask you a bit more about the pharaoh Hatshepsut, because we seem to see her constructions, her monuments, her image all around the Karnak complex.
Yes, the Queen Hatshepsut. She was one of the most important queens who did amazing work in Karnak. As I told you, the golden age and the golden time for Karnak temples, it was during the 18th dynasty. So, the Queen Hatshepsut, she was a woman, but she wanted to prove that, in spite she was a woman, she can do something like the men. So that she represented herself like the pharaohs, the men. She wore the headdress of the men. She wore the short skirt. She even wore the false beard, so that she represented herself just like a man. And she ruled for 22 years. And during this time, she did amazing job in Karnak temples. For example, we discovered in our restoration for the third gate or the third pylon, we discovered the red chapel, which belongs to the time of the Queen Hatshepsut. And it's one of the most important shrines on all of Karnak temples. It's built of quartzite stone, which they brought from El Jabal El Ahmar.
And this is red colored. This is great red colored
stone.
Yes,
exactly. So that we called it red chapel. And we think the red chapel of the Queen Hatshepsut was in the middle of Karnak temples instead of the shrine of the King Philip Aridaios. Originally, the shrine of the Queen Hatshepsut was there at the Holy of Holies, or the sacred bark of the Karnak temples. But later, maybe the King Thutmose and his follower, they dismantled this shrine and threw the stones away, until the king Amenophis III came and he decided to reuse this block again as fill in his gate, the third gate or the third pylon in the middle of, in the center of Karnak temples.
Now, there's one thing that I'd love to ask you about there, and we're going back to Amun here, but it's a key part of the Amun story, and that was the sacred bark, this boat. You see his depiction of it in the Chapeau Rouge as well. I mean, what was the sacred bark festival? Why was it so important?
Actually, the sacred bark of the god Amun, it wasn't just for one festival. No, actually, it was a wooden boat, and it had the most sacred statue, which made of pure gold. And they hide it inside a niche or a nose in the middle of the boat. And this boat was get out from the shrine to be carried on the shoulders of the priests during many celebrations and feasts, like the festival of the Obed, like the festival of the beautiful valley, when they used to carry this boat to go to Luxor Temple by the Nile or by the Sphinx Avenue. This is during the festival of Obed. Sometimes they cross the Nile with the boat, carrying on the shoulders of the priests, to go to the Valley of the Kings to visit the ancestors.
It seems such an important ceremony and so connected to Karnak through its long history. And to see, therefore, visual depictions on it of somewhere like the Chapelle Rouge of Hatshepsut. I mean, if we focus in on Hatshepsut and Amun's relationship, because time and time again, you don't only just see Hatshepsut at Karnak, but you see her alongside Amun, the sacred bark ceremony, and so many others. It's really interesting how closely connected she is to Amun.
Yes, exactly. Even some of the kings and queens in the Egyptian civilization claimed that they are the sons or the daughters of the god. One of these queens and kings, she was the queen Hatshepsut. She claimed that she was the daughter of the god Amun-Ra, so that she ruled Egypt, because she wasn't just a queen, she was the daughter of the god Amun-Ra, and she recorded this on a wall inside the birthday wall in Luxor Temple. We can say how the queen, she recorded that she was the daughter of the god Ra from her mother, the goddess Ahmos.
Now, one last thing on Hatshepsut before we move on. Got to ask about the obelisks of Hatshepsut at Karnak. Because talk to me a bit about the obelisks and also the restoration work of one fallen obelisk, which you've now, it's no longer fallen.
Actually, the Queen Hatshepsut, as I said before, she did a great job in Karnak temples. One of the most important features for this queen, the two obelisks, which she erected in the middle of Karnak temples, each one about 30 meters in height, and it made of red granite from the quarry in Aswan.
How far away is Aswan?
More than 500 kilometers.
Really? Wow!
Yes, more than 500 kilometers, just south of Luxor. So that it was a long, long way to bring this kind of stuff, especially when you know that the weight of this obelisk, more than 300 tons, one single piece of red granite.
I guess it's a great example of the effort that they were willing to go to get these monoliths up at a place like Karnak and then decorate them too. Were these solar symbols, were they associated with Amun? Can we imagine them being really beautiful to look at in ancient Egyptian times?
Actually, the decoration for many gods, like the god Amun, the god Amun-Min, this is another form of the god Amun, the goddesses like Isis, Hathor, Mut, all of these decorations, which colored, it's scattered and it's spread everywhere in Karnak temples. In spite, it defaced, many of these colors are destroyed because of the nature, because of the earthquakes, and unfortunately, because of the people who lived in the medieval times inside Karnak temples and reused some parts of the temple, so that all of this badly affect on the colors. Some parts are destroyed, some parts are covered by smog from the people who lived there and used to make the fire for cooking, for firing, so that the smog was covered completely these parts of the color. So that in spite of all of this, still you can see some perfect remains and amazing remains of the color everywhere, like in the hypostyle hall, like in the Holy of Holies in the middle of Karnak temples, in Khonsu temple, still exist some remains of the color who give us an idea how the temple was during the ancient times.
It is absolutely astonishing, and I love the fact that at this place, you know, you're reconstructing some 4,000-year-old buildings, you're cleaning away some of these columns to get the colour to show how beautiful it would have looked like thousands of years ago. You're re-erecting obelisks, like that fallen obelisk that has just recently been erected, hasn't it, of Hatshepsut?
Yes, we did. Actually, it's not a complete one, because this is the southern obelisk of the Queen Hatshepsut, but this is just the upper part. And this upper part was lying nearby the sacred lake for more than 100 years. And the Ministry of Tourism and Antiquities started to re-erect this part of the obelisk of the Queen Hatshepsut again just 3 months ago. We started to make restoration, preservation, and we made a new base for this part of the obelisk, and we re-erected again nearby to the sacred lake. It's about 10 meters in length and about 80 tons, more than 80 tons, just 10 meters of the whole length of the obelisk of the Queen Hatshepsut.
Well, Tayyip, I could ask questions for hours, but I'm going to wrap it up there for the moment. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you so much.
Well, there you go. There was the legend. That is Tayyip, the director of Karnak Temples, giving you an introduction to Karnak and why it is such an incredible place to go and visit. I loved visiting Karnak. Definitely one of the greatest ancient sites that I've ever been to. So I highly recommend, if anyone wants to go down the Nile in the future, or up the River Nile, so to speak, to definitely check out Karnak in Monday Luxor. You won't be disappointed. It's incredible. But that's enough from me. Last but certainly not least, if you'd be kind enough to leave us a lovely rating on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, wherever you get your podcast from, we, the whole team, well, we greatly appreciate it as we continue our mission to share these awesome stories from ancient history with you. It's been an absolute pleasure, and long may the Ancients podcast continue. But that's enough from me, and I'll see you in the next episode.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us, and you'll be doing us a big favor. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.